hoa hoa ko ko ho ia ka aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hana hano o ka moku aina o hoi. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is reconvened. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 16-0000807, Hawaii USA Federal Credit Union versus Donovan Joe Monolim, Misty Marie Monolim, Association of Apartment Owners of Beach Villas at Ko'olina, Ko'olina Community Association, Inc. Arguing for petitioner, Mr. Gary Victor Dubin. Arguing for respondent, Mr. Thomas J. Berger. Also appearing for respondent, Mr. Jonathan Lai. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Dubin, Mr. Berger, and Mr. Lai. Are you all ready to proceed today?
Yes, very well.
Mr. Dubin, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a warning light at 5 minutes to go. Mr. Berger will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go as well. Please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and my very respected and appreciated colleagues representing the respondents. I'm very pleased that I've had this opportunity to come before you in this case. As this court knows, you've had a number of very important foreclosure issues before you and have come out with a lot of very significant decisions in the last few years. I suggest to you that this case is the most significant foreclosure case to come before you. The issues here have never been before the Hawaii Supreme Court and an accepted certiorari. And I'd like to start by saying that this case can be summarized by a few numbers. The property was financed when it was purchased in 2008 for a total of $1,025,000. The tax assessment at the time was $1,171,600. In 2011, the property was in the process of foreclosure. There were three bidders at an auction. It was advertised three times in the smallest print imaginable in the classified section of the newspaper. And the winning bid was $493,282.04. I'm sorry, that was 2015. The winning bid was $760,000, several hundred thousand dollars below the purchase price, the finance price, and the tax assessed value.
What was the tax assessed value on the date, on that date?
The tax assessed value at the time?
At the time that the $760,000 bid went in.
It was $1,171,600.
I thought that was the tax assessed value at the time of purchase.
That was the time of purchase.
So at the time of the house that the unit was foreclosed on and it was sold at bid for $760,000, what was the assessed value on that date?
Okay, I have that information with me. The assessed value when it was foreclosed on, which was 2011, had dropped to $703,600 because of the sale. And this is important because when a property is sold at a forced sale, the cases agree that the value...
What was it in 2010?
Pardon?
What was the tax assessed value in 2010 before the sale?
2010? It was $770,900.
So the tax assessed value had dropped significantly between 2008 and 2010.
It did, because in that time it was in foreclosure.
Well, does the city factor that in as a part of its tax assessed value?
Well,
that's a fair market value. Well, the city...
It's a big drop, but... They assess it based upon sales that are taking place. And it's an
important
point
sales.
That when a property is sold to foreclosure, it diminishes the value of the adjoining properties.
Right, but what? But in 2010, this sale had yet to be finalized, right?
That's correct. It was $770,900.
Okay.
Then it was 2016, 4 or 5 years later, the respondent asked for a deficiency judgment and an additional $493,282.04 was awarded. Today, the tax assessed value has gone back up to $1,364,800. The principal issue in this case is that paragraph, I believe it's paragraph 9 of the fines of fact, said that if a deficiency judgment was requested, it had to be requested at the time of the confirmation of sale. And it wasn't. So I think it was 4.5 years went by, and then the respondent asked for a deficiency judgment. Of course, meanwhile, my clients had rearranged their affairs.
There wasn't a request for a deficiency at the time of the motion. I'm just looking at motion for confirmation of sale directing distribution of proceeds for deficiency judgment. And I believe that motion was heard. And if I understood correctly, Mr. Dubin, you noted an objection to the entry of a deficiency judgment. And then there's a notation in the minutes that the matter would be, let me be sure I get the exact right wording.
I think what normally happened with Judge Ayabi at that time, if you wanted a deficiency judgment, you would move for a deficiency judgment.
So it said, with objection made by Mr. Dubin, court ordered further hearing on deficiency judgment. The only question I had is, they had moved for a deficiency at the time of confirmation of sale, but you had objected in some way, at least that's what the record indicates. Is that an accurate understanding, or did something else take place?
That's correct.
Okay, so did your objection, even though the original judgment had anticipated that the deficiency judgment would be entered at the time of confirmation, is it fair to say or to suggest that because you objected, that's why it wasn't resolved at that time and moved off sometime into the future?
I don't think I have that power. I mean, I objected, and they didn't pursue it. They could have pursued it. It was the court's policy at the time to wait for a motion for the deficiency judgment. I think the motion for confirmation of sale and deficiency judgment was just kind of boilerplate language.
Mr. Dubin,
as well as my answer.
While you're on that, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but how long do you think Hawaii USA could wait before filing a motion for deficiency judgment?
Well, this is an issue that has bothered a lot of courts. A few courts on the mainland create a judge-made rule. They say, well, so much time. Some have said 4 years, some have said 6 years. Some have said you've got to do it at the time of the... I think the issue boils down to this language that was in the summary judgment that said if you want it, it has to be entered at the time of the confirmation of sale.
Mr. Dubin, aren't you waiving that argument by asking the court not to do it at the time of the confirmation?
Well, they never pursued it.
Well, I mean, your argument is that it needed to be entered simultaneously, and then you objected to it. So the argument that it needed to be simultaneous, isn't that waived?
Yeah. In terms of waiting, people are going to adjust their lives based upon the fact that there is no deficiency judgment requested.
But that's a different argument in a sense. I mean, that argument is based on the latches argument, which you made, that... Mm-hmm. Parties are not entitled to sit on their rights And if there's prejudice, which your clients allege, then that is actually, seems to me, a different contention than the one that they had to do at that moment.
It's certainly true in this case.
What is the prejudice that you're, besides the passage of time and that they've, as you said, readjust their financial affairs, what is the actual prejudice to your client?
I'm sorry, I was distracted.
I'm sorry, what was the actual prejudice to your client other than because of the passage of time that people have to readjust their financial affairs?
Well, my client submitted a declaration explaining the prejudice. And Judge Ayabi tried to be considerate and actually reduced a little bit the deficiency judgment by not adding the extra interest. So he recognized the unfairness, but still nevertheless entered a deficiency judgment.
How come that's not a, what would our standard of review be? Is it abuse of discretion? In other words, he seems to have recognized the merits of some of the arguments that you raised and made an adjustment. Why would we not defer to that judgment as to what the equities were in this situation?
I think it's because it's a question of credibility, and there was no evidentiary hearing. The other side argued that there was no prejudice, and he had no record to determine how much prejudice there was.
I thought you said you put in an affidavit.
Pardon?
I thought you said you put in an affidavit of your client as to what the prejudice was.
Yes, my client submitted the affidavit.
Okay, so there was evidence before the court.
Yes, but there was no inquiry into it. There was no evidentiary hearing.
Did he rule that I'm applying your client's more unfavorable position and use that as a basis to deduct the interest? Was that any, did he make any finding like that? And did he say I'm reviewing the latches defense, or he just?
My recollection was that he reduced it by not charging the interest because of the delay, the time delay.
Right, but did he correlate it in any way to the prejudice that your client would be in?
I don't believe so.
Isn't that intuitively obvious if he doesn't apply the interest that has accrued from the time of the confirmation of sale until the time this is made, the motion is made? If he disallows the interest.
Well, but that doesn't have anything to do with my clients changing their position in relationship to the deficiency judgment not having been pursued. But there's a bigger issue here.
What was the evidence that you would have admitted, would have sought to be admitted in an evidentiary, if there were an evidentiary hearing regarding prejudice?
Well, the other side had raised an issue that my clients own more properties, et cetera. And that was put in the record. We never had an opportunity to rebut that with an evidentiary hearing. But
so your evidence that you would have put in would have said what?
We would have shown on the record my client's financial condition, what it was at the time, and how they struggled to improve their credit score and their finances, and how they relied upon the fact that there was no deficiency judgment, and the fact that they would have filed bankruptcy and wiped it out at the time, and now it would be highly prejudiced. But there's a bigger issue here, because you can't divorce the deficiency judgment from the fact that the test is the judge-made rule that you take the amount of the sale and you compare that to the amount
of the
money supposedly owed. And other courts, the majority of the state courts, have decided that that is unfair. Florida, Mississippi, Vermont, Montana, Colorado, Kentucky, their courts on their own without legislative guidance or statutes decided it's unfair, and they look for the true value of the property. So it's not only the fact that my clients had to experience this shock to their finances after 5 years, but the fact that the deficiency judgment was bloated.
Why isn't the time of confirmation of sale the appropriate time to determine the correct sale price of the most appropriate, or whether the sale price was appropriate? Why isn't the confirmation of sale? Isn't that usually when it's done?
Yeah, but the confirmation of sale, you know, is whether the auction price, high bid, shocks the conscience of the court. That's a different test. In the majority of states, the court then says, well, okay, what's the real value of the property? And then holds an evidentiary hearing to determine how much of a deficiency judgment is really appropriate in terms of the loss of the lender. Many times these properties are sold after the confirmation of sale for higher prices.
No, that's true. Now, yeah. There are a lot of times when at first blush it does seem to shock the conscience, especially with condos. And it goes for an outrageously low price, but there are tons of liens and AOAO assessments attached to it. So while the fair market value of a property could be assessed at a certain point or determined at a certain point, but the actual sale value could be much lower.
Well, that's a good point, but in those states that have the evidentiary hearing, they take that into account. That has to be taken into account in determining the value.
Isn't that also taken into account to determine whether or not the amount paid for the property at the confirmation of sale? Doesn't the court take that into account there also?
I have to tell you, I've had hundreds of these cases, and I have seen the life savings of people forfeited because of false, forced auction sales that result in low prices. When people bid at the auction, they take into account the liens you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
Mr. Dubin, is it your position that such an evidentiary hearing should be held in every case in which a deficiency judgment is sought, or only in cases that meet a certain threshold? And if so, what would that threshold be?
There ought to be a test like in those states. The majority of states should be a test via an evidentiary hearing. I'm reminded of what Justice Douglas said in the Guilford case. Mortgagees are constitutionally entitled to no more than payment in full. In that case, he reasoned that there's an equitable issue as to how much is the real loss. And that was a 1941 case, and it was and that was reversed by the United States Supreme Court. That was a New York case. And after that, at 61 Supreme Court, 898, and after that, you had these judicial decisions in the majority of states, as well as statutes, which tried to correct the balance. Now, it's really interesting to reflect on the fascinating history of all this, because this came out of the common law, the English courts. The law courts just said, you haven't paid your mortgage, goodbye, and you lost everything, any equity you had in it. And then the equity courts of England decided, that's not fair, let's hold an auction. Well, at that time, they didn't have an MLS book. They didn't have realtors. So they held an auction in the community, and the communities were small. And people in the community, would be the ones to buy the property. But today, it's curious what happens in history. Today, the auction, which is at the heart of what we're challenging here, the auction is a home for thieves. People go and bid at the auction, and it's recognized.
So that comes back to my question. In every case in which there's a deficiency judgment, should there be an evidentiary hearing, or only in some certain categories? And one reason I ask that question is the tax assessed value here was less than the amount obtained at the auction, and there were multiple bidders at the auction, and the bidder was, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, not the credit union, or the winning bidder was an entity or person other than the credit union. So what in the record here, you know, requires or suggests that such a hearing was necessary?
Well,
or is it that they're necessary in every case? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Three responses. In the majority of states, it's necessary in every case, but attorney's fees are assessed. So if someone doesn't have a reasonable case and they ask for this, the court can assess them attorney's fees and costs. Also, they have to get an appraiser, which costs them money as well. So it's just like any other litigation. If you want to sue, you're going to be subject to the costs involved. Secondly, we don't know what the true value was. You know, the assessed values go up and down. The only way to have a true value is to have appraisers, people who are experienced, tell you what the values are. I've had all kinds of things happen. I had a case of the lot was worth about $700,000, went into foreclosure. It sold for $1.2 million because the neighboring homeowners were fighting over it, and we actually got more money than we would have expected.
I'm a little bit confused, that if a lender is going to seek a deficiency judgment, that the sale should be through MLS instead of at a public auction? Through, you know, a realtor, through the normal process, in order to ascertain the true market value?
The state of the law is such that I'm asking, as they do in the majority of jurisdictions, that they separate the issue as to confirming the sale and the issue of, okay, now let's look at the foreclosure blight and see what the real value was.
Well, as you said, there's two different standards. One is shocking the conscience and setting it aside, and the other is determining what the true value of the property is.
Yes. Now I have concerns about the shocking the conscience of the court issue, but that's not what I'm addressing.
So the hearing would be if there's a request for a deficiency judgment, not in every instance where there's a confirmation of sale requested. Is that
That's right.
Correct?
You have to request a deficiency judgment review at an evidentiary hearing.
And if that request is made, then the mortgagee has to come in with an appraisal or other evidence.
And the other side would come in with an appraisal, and you'd have an evidentiary hearing.
And that was your proposal?
That's
in this case, that you would have an expert testify as to the true value at the time in 2011 when the foreclosure occurred?
Now, this property is right across from the Disneyland at Coalina, and we feel it was a valuable property. And
as of 2011?
As of 2011. And I know it was sold for $760,000. I've had cases where lenders have given a retirement bonus to employees and didn't bid. Now, this is a very unusual case because the respondent could have bid up to, it looks like, over $1 million.
They had a check. Their down payment would have allowed them to bid up to.
No, it would be a credit bid.
Credit. Oh, well, yeah.
They were owed about $1 million. Normally,
okay. Okay.
Normally, the lender doesn't want to rely upon a deficiency judgment that can be wiped out in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. But in this case, they let it go.
Weren't there 11 bids?
That's
there are quite a few bids on this property, right?
Yeah, it's very rare.
And they, regardless, and then sold for, and eventually for $760,000.
That's right.
So you're saying the lender could have credit bid on this?
Could have credit bid up to over $1 million.
Yes, and so clearly over the $760,000 sales price. And if they had held on to it, however, until 2016, and sold it for the $1.4 million.
And I can tell you, in almost every case, the lender will bid their full credit bid because the property is, you know, a lot of times they'll fix it up and they'll get more for it or they'll hold on to it. But that's real dollars to the lender. Whereas a deficiency judgment can be wiped out with a Chapter 7. And my client.
But, you know, when you look at the hearing, and I didn't look at the record, but the judge, a representation was made to Judge Ayabe at the time that your clients had five additional properties. So that the assertion that you could have filed for Chapter 7 at that time to wipe this out if the deficiency judgment had been sought was actually not a very valid argument as an equitable argument.
Well, that's my point, because where's the evidence that they had five properties? And if they had more properties, how about the mortgages on those properties? How about the partners they had in the LLCs? So how do you determine that except by...
Did you put that in an affidavit? Was that included in your client's affidavit? Information regarding the other properties?
That came up later, I think, in the reply papers. That's how it happened. I see my time is up, but I think the important thing is that there's a lot of issues in this case, and it's a little myopic just to consider the issue of an evidentiary hearing when, in fact, the sale itself should not be the measure of the true value of the property. And that's why a majority of the states, many by judicial decision alone, have created an evidentiary hearing. And no state court yet has related the unfairness to the constitutional rule against forfeitures. And my clients, the Monolems, are just the petitioners in this case. But there's tens of thousands of Hawaii residents who have lost their life savings, hundreds of millions of dollars, in a system that doesn't inquire into the true value and give them a chance in an evidentiary hearing. And in the future, there's going to be tens of thousands of Hawaii residents if this court does not act equitably in our judgment, that will lose their life savings because of this judge-made rule that allows for this measurement of the deficiency judgment based upon an untrue value.
Well, Mr. Dubin, I'm looking at what you said at the deficiency hearing, and you're saying the amount of the deficiency according to the decree of foreclosure has to be determined at the time of confirmation. Every deficiency judgment situation, there ought to be an evidentiary hearing determine what that was. But what you're talking about is the decree of foreclosure to be determined at the time of confirmation. I guess that instead of that day. But I don't see you saying the fair market value in here.
Well, it would be the actual value at the time. In other words, the property is sold at auction for X amount of money.
I know what you mean. I'm just saying I don't know if you said that in order to preserve it.
Well, that's the issue. That's the fundamental issue. More important than just whether the respondent waited for 4.5 years. Anyway, I have a couple of minutes I'd like to reserve.
Thank you, Mr. Dubin. We'll hear from Mr. Berger now.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I did want to clarify, Justice Akiyama did bring up a point about the record and the question of whether the Monolems here personally owned other properties. And I do believe the record is clear that the tax assessed value information for the five other properties was attached to the credit union's reply memo filed in support of the motion for deficiency judgment, and that showed the owner's name as being the Monolins in their individual capacities. So my friend, Mr. Dubin, talked about limited liability companies, and I don't think that's in the record.
Did it show the mortgage amounts for those properties? Your reply.
Justice McKenna, I don't believe it did. And you wouldn't be able to glean that information from the tax information on file.
But your position is that there was a sufficient hearing conducted at the time of the confirmation. Is that it? There isn't an additional evidentiary hearing necessary?
Yes, Justice Wilson, I understand the question. And our position is that the order and deficiency judgment should be affirmed, and that in this case, there shouldn't have been an evidentiary hearing. So my friend Mr. Dubin cites
to... And why is that?
Yes.
No, I'm asking why shouldn't there have been in this case?
Yes, I understand the question, Justice Pollack, and I was about to answer that, yes. So my friend Mr. Dubin talks about the majority view and how the majority view is applied all across the country. So if I could have a long answer to your question.
Sure.
So the majority view, if you look at the restatement third of property mortgages, section 8.4, and I believe this court in Reyes-Toledo cited to the restatement third of property mortgages as in a footnote. So the court's familiar with that authority. And if you look at that section, it talks about how the burden is on the borrower, here the Monolins, to come forward with some evidence to show that the fair market value of the real estate at the time of the foreclosure sale would be different. So in this record, they didn't come forward with any evidence to show that the fair market value of the sale was different.
It says, I'm reading from the restatement, it says, any person against whom such a recovery is sought may request in the proceeding in which the action for deficiency is pending a determination of the fair market value of the real estate as of the date of the foreclosure sale. Then I'm looking at the response to your motion down at the court, and there's a discussion where Mr. Dubin asks, he says, their state courts must hold a special evidentiary hearing to determine the fair value of the foreclosed property, which is not necessarily the auction price. So is it your position that he didn't make a sufficient request?
Yes, Judge, that is our position. That, you know, the Monolins are represented by counsel, and they're moving the court to have an evidentiary hearing. They should come forward with some basis for the request, something more. They have an opportunity to respond to the motion. So they had time to come up with an appraisal or some other piece of information to justify an evidentiary hearing. So on this record...
So in other words, you would accept that the law in our jurisdiction is that if you do request, you're entitled to it, and the failure in this case, that there wasn't a sufficient request made to obtain a hearing.
You know, Justice Pollack, that's a complicated question because we have various circuits, and the foreclosure judges in each circuit take different approaches to how a deficiency judgment would be handled. So I can't speak to how each judge in the various circuits would answer that question. I would say that I do believe some circuit court judges would give them the right. And I believe my friend Mr. Dubin could speak to that. To my knowledge, there hasn't been an evidentiary hearing done. So the short answer would be no.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the last thing.
Yes, so to my knowledge, you know, having practiced in foreclosure law for a decade or so, almost a decade, there hasn't been an evidentiary hearing as to the issue of a deficiency judgment.
But I thought you said there's some who might. I thought I heard you immediately before that say there's some circuit judges who do hold such hearings.
To clarify my point, I do believe if the Monolins raise the issue correctly, that some circuit judges would be open to the idea.
Even though it hasn't in fact happened?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have that insight into the minds of our circuit court judges, or because of things that have been said or orders that have been written or something?
Yeah, yes, Judge.
Okay.
I do believe that circuit court judges would look at the issue precisely, and if they came forward with a coherent argument about what the majority view is, with coherent evidence to justify having an evidentiary hearing, I do believe some of our circuit court judges, not all of them, would probably give the Monolins the right to such a hearing.
In this case, where there is a position being taken by the Monolins that there is a discrepancy between the true value and the sale price, what more do you need for a hearing? Are you suggesting there needs to be some expert testimony in the form of an affidavit in order to establish the right for a hearing?
Well, I think in this case, we would ask the court, our position is that in this case, the record is sufficient to affirm the order of Judge Ayabe and the deficiency judgment. To answer the court's question.
Is that because from an equitable point of view, the sale was fair? Is that your point?
Well, yes, Judge. This property was sold to a third party, and it was a public sale. So the marketplace determined that the sale price was $760,000.
Well, actually, there are circuit judges that have actually required listing and sale, right? It doesn't have to be at a public auction, right?
Typically, for foreclosures, it would be a public auction, but...
Typically, but it doesn't have to be, correct? I mean, this is an equitable action.
You know, Justice McKenna, to my knowledge, I haven't seen in a foreclosure where the judge has required the property to be listed in the MLS, but I believe that some of the commissioners are realtors and they will list the property in the MLS.
And then, so why shouldn't it be listed in every situation? Why should we allow attorney commissioners that can't list in the MLS then? I mean, doesn't everybody now look for properties through the MLS?
Well, Justice McKenna, that's not in the record, but I think, yeah.
We could take judicial notice of that, right?
I mean, I think they do. Here, you know, Mr. Dubin is a very fine attorney, and he can come to the Judge Ayabe at the decree of foreclosure stage, and they can ask for instructions to the commissioner to specifically hire a realtor to put this on the MLS.
And right. In terms of this case, there was no request that the foreclosure decree allowed this to be sold per the public auction, correct? Through appointment of a commissioner and the sale through a public auction. Did this decree allow that, the foreclosure decree?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And that was not appealed or challenged, correct?
I believe it was appealed, and I believe the appeal was dismissed for want of prosecution.
I see. Okay.
And foreclosure auctions are different because the bidders are required to come to the auction with a certain amount of cash, right?
A foreclosure auction is different from a traditional sale. It's an involuntary sale, and the procedure customarily was set forth in the decree of foreclosure, and customarily the third-party purchaser who wants to buy the property has to come up with 10% in certified funds in order to bid. So 10% of what their max bid would be.
At the time of the bid, right?
At the time of the bid. And there is a second opportunity for the public to come and bid on the property. So at the auction, the property sold to John Doe. There's a motion to confirm the sale, and then a third party can come in, Jane can come in at the motion to confirm sale. And as long as she bids at least 5% more than the original sale price, then the bidding is reopened. And this happens all the time.
Mr. Burton, I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
No, please go ahead. Well, I was going to jump to the issue of latches. So if you had another question on this issue, please.
I think I should defer to you because I was going to do the same thing.
All right. Why shouldn't the doctrine of latches apply to bar your client's claim in this case?
Yes, Justice Recknold. So I think here latches customarily is applied to bar a claim. And the distinction in this case is the claim was already filed. So to use latches as a defense to completely bar the claim would be unfair. So our position would be that the doctrine of latches is not the correct equitable matter.
What if this was 20 years later?
Yeah, those facts are, under that hypothetical, I believe, Mr. Dubin or another counsel could come forward and present a coherent argument that the 10-year statute of limitations for the judgment would have expired So if the deficiency judgment had been entered in 2011, by 2021 it would have expired, and then it would have expired 10 more years later, so it's completely barred.
Well, why do you need a latches argument if statute of limitations is going to apply? Or some, I mean, it seems like you're subjecting the latches argument to be controlled by statute of limitations. Aren't they separate principles? Isn't this is an equitable action, and doesn't latches apply?
Well, Justice Pollack, I believe latches is an equitable maxim that can be used to, in conjunction with the statute of limitations, as to a claim that was brought late to court. It hasn't been filed with the court. I believe if you review the case law on latches, customarily it's applied where a claim perhaps is filed and not served, or a claim is filed right before the statute of limitations is about to run.
But if they're equitable doctrines, why wouldn't the same policy concerns that motivate the application of latches in those typical situations not apply here?
And yes, Justice Recklemont, I think my answer in our position is that latches is not the correct equitable doctrine to, I guess, either, well, first of all.
So what is?
Right. So I think, you know, a better equitable doctrine would be set forth in Pollack v. Pollack, 52 Hawaii 357. It's a 1970 case. And in that case, the court talks about how equity will consider that as done which ought to be done. So here, you know, my friend Mr. Dubin, at the hearing on the motion to confirm sale, complained about the deficiency judgment, and he wanted to have, I guess, further hearing on that. So, and this is not in the record. And again, our position is the order on deficiency judgment should be affirmed. But there is an argument to be made that under that equitable maxim, that perhaps the length of the deficiency judgment should be shortened from 10 years to, say, what it should have been from, you know, the date it should have been entered in 2011 or 12. I think that is a more equitable and fair result than just completely barring the claim. You know, the money is still owed to the credit union, the principal balance.
Okay, but it appears that if there was a latches proceeding to determine that issue, maybe, in fact, your client would prevail because he asked for the matter to be delayed. Maybe he can't show sufficient prejudice. Maybe there wasn't sufficient length of the period. But those are all factual issues. And here, there was no hearing. There was no consideration. The judge doesn't make any ruling on it. The judge just issues this order. It's as if the judge just didn't recognize it at all.
You know, Justice Pollack, we disagree with that position. I do believe Judge Ayabe did consider the facts, and under the traditional view for calculating a deficiency judgment, it would have been correct.
Well, didn't the judge ask you why did it take so long? And you said, I don't know if it was you, but whoever appeared at the hearing said, well, it's attorney-client privilege. We can't talk about it. And then the judge says, okay, and then moved on. There's nothing even in the record to justify the almost 4.5-year delay or whatever.
Right. And again, Justice Pollack, our position is that the burden is on Mr. Dubin to come forward with evidence that the fair market value would have been something different from the sale price. So to answer your question about...
Well, I'm talking prejudice and latches right now.
Right.
Mr. Berger, your argument is latches doesn't apply because you filed the claim time very quickly after the foreclosure. It was just the delay and the consideration, your request of the court to consider it. And part of it is due to Mr. Dubin's request that it be delayed. So your claim is that latches just doesn't apply in a case when the claim has already been made.
Justice Nakayama, that is correct. That is our position.
But didn't you file your motion in 2016, which is what brought this to the head?
And Justice Pollack, I think there's a more practical rule. I mean, my friend Mr. Dubin could have filed a motion to dismiss for want of prosecution, and then he could have proven up his prejudice.
Well, practically speaking, why would he want to wake a sleeping dog. I mean, if you guys had forgotten it, why would you? Why is it his job to, oh, remind you, by the way, I haven't filed
I'm waiting for my
deficiency judgment.
Yes. Well, he had the prerogative. He had the right to do so. I mean, the claim is still outstanding. In any civil action, once a claim is filed, either side has a burden to either.
Your argument is that as a matter of law, latches cannot be asserted in this situation. Is that right?
No, Justice McKenna. What I'm saying is in review of the case law on latches, I don't believe that's the correct equitable maxim to be applied in this.
Okay, so if we were to determine that latches can be raised as a defense under these circumstances, then do you think that Mr. Monolam's declaration raised a question of fact as to whether or not latches could apply under these circumstances?
You know, Justice McKenna, I don't think it did. And the reason is because the statements that were actually made in, I can't recall if it was an affidavit or a declaration that was filed in the case. So the Monolams were complaining about what they would have done outside the proceeding. They were complaining about actions involving filing a separate case, a separate paper.
Basically, I think they were saying, you know, if you had moved forthwith, we could have filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy and wiped out this debt, and now we're not in a position to file for bankruptcy because we have other things going on, and now we can't file for bankruptcy.
Right, and Justice McKenna, the distinction is for latches, customarily, it's matters within the case. So evidence is destroyed, perhaps somebody passed away. I think what the Monolams were arguing is something outside of the proceeding. It's no different than saying, you know, Judge Ayabe, I bought a property in Molokai with the money I was going to use to pay off the credit union.
Could you provide me the case law that talks about latches being limited to matters within the case?
One moment, Judge.
Is it in your briefs?
I
hadn't focused on that.
You know, when I looked at the research on latches, I was looking at the Association of Apartment Owners versus Certified Management, 139 Hawaii 229. I don't believe it stands for the proposition that I stated explicitly, but I do believe when you review the cases and the facts, there's an implicit, I guess, limiting factor to when the doctrine is applied. So when you review the facts of those cases, customarily latches is applied to bar a claim that was filed late. And
because there's some prejudice.
And customarily, when you look at the case law, it's prejudice within the case.
Like loss of witnesses or things like that.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, that. So here I have a cite for that. It would be Association of Apartment Owners versus Venture 15 Incorporated, 115 Hawaii 232. 2007 decision, where the court says, common but by no means exclusive examples of prejudice are loss of evidence.
Common but no sense exclusive, right?
Yes, Judge, that's correct.
How about this? And I'm quoting, what qualifies as prejudice for purposes of the latches doctrine invariably depends on the facts and circumstances of a particular case, but it is ordinarily understood as anything that places the defendant in a less favorable position. That's from a 2016 case, Herman versus Herman, 138 Hawaiian. And also, they later go on and give examples, and some of them are indeed examples where there's an adverse effect on the case, but they also mention changes in the value of the subject matter and changes in a defendant's position and even intervening rights of third parties. So I'm not so sure it's so narrow. I think it's correct to say that commonly or many times it does affect the case. But it also seems
I'm interested in the 4.5-year delay. So your position is that the defendants had to come forward with information about why the credit union had waited 4 years when the credit union wouldn't answer a question about that on the basis of attorney-client privilege. Is that your position? What exactly were they supposed to do?
Well, I think on this record, it's not clear what actually happened for the delay. But I think...
Because you refused to answer the question. I mean, counsel for the... I'm not saying you personally, but...
So, you know...
How can we hold that against them? I mean, you're saying, I thought I heard you say earlier, it was their burden to come forward and explain the delay. I mean, how can that be when the information is uniquely within the possession of the plaintiff?
Yes, Justice Rechtenwald. I think when you look at equity can kind of adjust to the circumstances of the case. So I think here, to answer your question, there is no information on the record to justify or explain the delay. But I don't think it's relevant under the traditional or majority view for calculating a deficiency judgment. So I think...
No, we're talking about latches. So, I mean, should we assume that that factor, can we hold that factor against the defendants in this case, given the record?
And again, Justice Rechtenwald, our position is latches does not...
I understand. I'm just giving you the opportunity to argue latches in the event that we do decide it's relevant, and what's your position with regard to that first prong, that the burden is on them, and therefore is that... I just want to understand your position. So if we were to go and determine that latches is the applicable doctrine, what is the position of the credit union with regard to the unreasonableness of delay in this case?
Okay. Okay, so assuming the doctrine does apply.
Yes.
Then
what's your position with regard to the first of the two prongs of the doctrine? Unreasonableness of the delay.
Okay. I think our position would be that the circuit court could look at both sides and could make a decision that the debtor had equal opportunity to come to the court, the debtor being represented by counsel, to adjudicate the final claim as the damages being the deficiency judgment, equally as the credit union could. So our position would be that
have as much knowledge about what happened inside the credit union to cause a four-year delay as you do, or as the credit union does?
Well, it's a claim for damages, so it's still outstanding within the case.
Yeah.
So any party in civil action can come to adjudicate what the damages should be in this action. And the monolins could have come forward and said, here, based on the delay, the deficiency judgment should be zero. And our response would be, no, Your Honor, because the principal balance is still outstanding.
The delay was, there was no unreasonable delay. Counsel, what was the reason for the delay? I declined to answer on the basis of attorney-client privilege. Is that a record sufficient to find that there was no unreasonable delay here?
Well, if you look at the appellate history, there was an appeal filed of the decree of foreclosure. So it wouldn't be unreasonable for the credit union to wait until that appeal has ran.
Okay. And that was 2012, right?
It was another year about. And then if you look at the additional delays, I don't have an answer for Your Honor about that.
But isn't that a point to be made in favor of a hearing? I mean, you have conceded that under certain circumstances a latches analysis might apply, and in terms of making that determination, a hearing would seem to be necessary. And what would be, I don't quite understand your objection to the idea of a hearing. I think it is that hearings are appropriate to determine a deficiency judgment's fairness sometimes, but just not in this case. Is that correct?
Yes, Justice.
And if that's the position, why not have a hearing at least to determine the extent to which latches applies, if at all?
So our position would be that, you know, just to reiterate, that latches wouldn't be the correct equitable doctrine.
Okay, so let's get beyond that.
Yes.
And assuming that we find that latches applies, can apply, your motion is in the nature of a motion for summary judgment as to the amount of the deficiency judgment, is it not?
That's one way of looking at it.
Right. So if there is a question of fact as to whether or not latches apply, then is it a hearing or is it a trial as to the amount, as to whether or not a deficiency judgment can be obtained, and if so, what the amount is? Or I guess the court could determine as a matter of law whether latches would bar the claim.
Yes, Justice McKinnon, I mean...
Or would it be a trial on latches? I'm a little bit confused.
It would depend on what the moving papers say, whether there's an issue of material fact. But under the traditional view for calculating a deficiency judgment, latches wasn't something that the court would necessarily consider. Under the majority view, which we talked about earlier in this discussion, latches isn't something, to my recollection, the court would usually consider. Some of the cases did talk about latches. But I think here, based on this record, our position would be that any rule should be prospective.
But mortgage foreclosure in general is an equitable remedy, right? Mortgage foreclosure is an equitable remedy, right?
That's correct.
So are you suggesting that the equitable remedy doesn't apply to the deficiency judgment prong?
I think it's more complicated than that. I think it's more a legal determination under the traditional view for calculating a deficiency judgment.
So you're saying that the equitable determination is only as to the foreclosure decree, and when it comes to deficiency judgment, confirmation of sale and deficiency, that's a legal remedy?
You know, Justice McKinnon, I think Hawaii case law is pretty clear that equity can be considered at any time
right.
for foreclosures.
Right.
So.
Anything further at this point for the court?
Oh, I want to ask you further about what the Chief Justice said. If latches does apply, one of the prongs is unreasonableness of the delay. Are you conceding you presented no evidence as to whether it was reasonable?
I believe
or are you just saying 4 years is reasonable, per se?
You know, I think here 4 years would not be unreasonable because the judgment could be good for 10 years. If it was entered in 2011, the judgment would have been good for 10 years. It can be extended for another 10. So it's not unreasonable because the court had the legal opportunity when moved upon to enter the deficiency judgment. And then, you know, the case I cited earlier about, you know, Pollock v. Pollock, I think the more...
So it's your position the court could have made the judgment less than the statutory requirement of 10 years? Isn't the statute say judgments are good for 10 years?
Yes, Justice Pollock, that's what the statute says. But my point is, I think there's a more applicable, equitable maxim than latches. You know, the money was still owed to the credit union, and there was a delay, but the correct equitable solution is not to deny the credit union the principal balance that it was due. It's to adjust the equities and come up with a reasonable solution. And here, based on this record, our position is that the order and deficiency judgment should be affirmed.
But in a sense, you're getting a judgment longer than the 10 years because, in a sense, this person's on the hook for 4 and 5 years that you delayed it, and then the additional 10 years, and then if it's extended, another 10.
Right.
Under your theory, you could have waited 9 years, right? Or nine years and 364 days, because there's at least one day left on the 10-year judgment.
Yeah, if you run through the hypothetical, I believe that would be correct. And I think my final point in closing would be...
Could I just ask the Pollock versus Pollock, the doctrine, the other equitable doctrine that you're referring to, is that the case that sets forth that doctrine?
Yes, Your Honor. Pollock v. Pollock, 52 Hawaii 357.
Okay, and was that argued by you in your briefing, for example, in the ICA?
No, Your Honor, it wasn't.
Okay, very well.
And just the final point I have was, if the court is inclined to create a rule for how deficiency judgments should be calculated, our position would be it should be a prospective rule. And, you know, when you're a first-year law student, you have to read Jenkins versus Cade Shuddy, 76 Hawaii 115, 1994. And in that case, the court recognized the extraordinary burden that would occur if it had entered a ruling that was to apply retroactively. And here, I mean, if the court is inclined to adopt the majority view and to adopt a new rule for calculating deficiency judgments, our position would be it should be prospective in application.
But didn't you tell us that some judges are applying it already, and that if he had asked for it, he might have gotten it? So usually new rules are when you're totally changing the, you know, the situation. And I thought you acknowledged that some courts were allowing it, and I may have misunderstood what you said.
Well, Justice Pollack, you know, to clarify my point, it was a hypothetical. I believe if Mr. Dubin, my friend Mr. Dubin, had come to the court and presented a coherent argument Judge, this is the majority view around the country, and look, attached to our motion, our opposition is an appraisal that shows the fair market value for this property is actually $1 million. Then there would have been an issue of fact, and the court could have had an evidentiary hearing. But on this record, that didn't occur. So under the traditional or majority view for calculating a deficiency judgment, we believe the circuit court was correct in entering the order and judgment as entered. Thank you.
Very well, thank you. Mr. Berger, Mr. Dubin, your rebuttal. How much time does Mr. Dubin have remaining?
1:38.
All right. Well, take a stab. We asked. We did ask some questions that ran into your time, but try to keep it succinct.
To make 6 quick points. First of all, if there's any question about whether $670,000 was fair, okay, it was advertised in small type in a classified section 3 times. The commissioner was an attorney. Who here would suggest that that procedure would get a true price? Secondly,
and yet 11 people bid on it, right?
There were, I guess, the respondent and 2 others.
But there weren't 11 people?
That's hard. You know, who would want to sell their home under those conditions? I don't think anybody on the bench would. That's not the normal procedure. Second point is, you were told that some judges might consider it if asked. Well, I've had like something like 500 cases the last 10 years of foreclosures. I raise it all the time. Nobody has ever agreed to it, and there's been many more egregious cases than this on those facts. 3, it's a question of fairness. This court in Condor versus Matsuyoshi, in Santiago versus Tanaka, in non-judicial context, pursued fairness doctrines. Same thing should be true in judicial foreclosures. 4, borrowers are not deadbeats. No one can go 30 years without a death in the family, a loss of a job, sickness, divorce. These people should not be looked upon as deadbeats, and they have, majority of Americans have their life savings in their homes, and there ought to be a more humane, fair way of treating them. Also regarding whether whatever this court does should be retroactive or prospective or not, I point out that this court rejected in Matsuyoshi the federal doctrine and looked at the Urich case about fairness and said that that was not a new rule. And in fact, to its credit, the Intermediate Court of Appeals has been applying it as an old rule in cases. I would suggest, in fairness, that the issue here is true value. That's what started this whole process. And that for purposes of retroactivity versus prospective application, obviously we don't want to dig up cases from the dead, but I would think that anyone who is facing, for example, collection based upon a deficiency judgment that was determined without an evidentiary hearing should have the benefit of Your Honor's wisdom. And finally, I just want to point out that what we're talking about here is judge-made law. It wasn't made by the Hawaii legislature. It was made by our judiciary. And that's why this court has the clear ability to change this rule. And I just refer, in closing, to what Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, quote, "It is revolting to have no better reason for a rule of law, and so it was laid down in the time of Henry IV. It is still more revolting if the grounds upon which it was laid down have vanished long since and the rule simply persists from blind imitation of the past." Who here would fashion the present foreclosure system when somebody is in default? To put them through this emotional turmoil, and also to put the courts through this ordeal as well.
Very well. Anything further at this point, Mr. Dubin?
Just to thank all of you very much.
All right. So thank you to both of our counsel for their arguments here today. The court will take this matter under advice.
Iku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku ia mai ne, kea aha ho'okolokolo kie ha'ano'ano o ka moku'aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.